Not that this election needs more cynicism, mind you, but politics, for all of its many virtues, is also a business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 2nd of November. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The business of politics coming up in the second half of the program today. We'll start, however, with a little macroeconomic audio quiz, all right? Courtesy of Chair Janet Yellen and the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee. They wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates today. Cutting to the chase, no rate hike, as we knew going in. But just to give you some sense of the parsing that happens when the Fed meets, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you the operative sentence from the Fed's statement last time it met. That was in September. And then the parallel sentence from this morning's statement. See if you can tell the difference. All right. So here you go. This is September.
The committee judges that the case for an increase in the federal funds rate has strengthened, but decided, for the time being, to wait for further evidence of continued progress toward its objectives.
All right. You got it? Okay. So here is today's statement.
The committee judges that the case for an increase in the federal funds rate has continued to strengthen, but decided, for the time being, to wait for some further evidence of continued progress toward its objectives.
Not so simple, was it? And you think it's easy being a business reporter, don't you? Here is today's statement again, this time with a little, you know, assistance.
The committee judges that the case for an increase in the federal funds rate has continued to strengthen, but decided for the time being to wait for some further evidence of continued progress toward its objectives.
Did you get it? Continued to strengthen and some further evidence? That was pretty much it. Data, as Chair Yellen likes to say, all of which is to say, yeah, we're going to do this again next month, minus the quiz, probably December 13th and 14th is the next time the Fed meets. There are, as I'm sure you are aware, just 6 short days left until the election, 3 trading sessions. So there is a certain anxiousness afoot in the markets. Gigi Duban has the story.
Plot out the volatility index and picture a roller coaster. Some say this index tracks fear, which we see in risky trading environments. Brenda Kelly, an independent market strategist, says there's a lot more volatility this week than last week. Part of that is tied to the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency, which makes Wall Street nervous.
Or indeed, even if Ms. Clinton wins it, that there might be continued investigations. And of course, that will hamper political certainty.
Which means financial uncertainty. Kelly is, of course, referring to the latest FBI probe announced Friday into more Clinton emails. Since then, the VIX volatility index has gone up almost 30%.
That tells you that more people are nervous and more people are questioning what the markets hold. And when they question, they sell.
That's Mark Lehman, president of JNP Securities. Selling drives stock prices down. And Lehman says to some, that's an opportunity to buy shares in companies that are trading lower now. Pravit Chintawongvanich is head derivative strategist at Macro Risk Advisors. He's seeing a lot of fund managers hedge ahead of the elections, and it's driving up the cost of stock options.
You know, they have to, as their duty, to protect their portfolios and go out and, you know, spend some premium on buying protection. And I think that's what you're seeing right now.
He says they're essentially buying insurance. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
6 days, 3 sessions. Remember that. All right, moving on. As this economy changes, so do its constituent parts. For our purposes today, that would be banking. For the first time in 30 years, old line deposit holding institutions like banks and credit unions aren't making the majority of home mortgage loans in this country. In the third quarter, and this is according to the trade publication Inside Mortgage Finance, non-banking companies, companies like Quicken Loans or PennyMac, made 51% of the home loans out there. Marketplace's Adam Ellington explains why that matters.
This is not a statistical blip or some kind of fluke. Banks are cutting back on the amount of mortgages they lend.
I think it's just a natural evolution of the market at this point.
Rocky Andrews is the past president of the National Association of Mortgage Brokers. In the wake of the foreclosure crisis, he says a wave of new rules made the big banks vulnerable to government regulators looking to sue.
They like to go after deep pockets, and they end up finding people that way, and that's why the banks are getting out of them, not because the loans themselves are more risky.
Some say the bank's move to cut down on lending simply shifts the riskier mortgages over to the non-banks. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says if the economy did take another nosedive, non-banks are more exposed.
They're not banks. They don't have huge deposit bases to fall back on. They're relatively light on assets.
Meaning if defaults increase rapidly, would non-banks have enough cushion? Absolutely, says Jay Farner, president of Quicken Loans.
Our asset base is in the top 6 or 7% of all banks in the country.
Farner points out that Quicken also has to meet the same increased credit requirements now mandated by the government.
We have contracts in place with FHA, Fannie, Freddie, VA. You've got to make a quality loan. If you don't, you'll be on the hook to buy that loan back.
While the bank's share of mortgage lending is down, their portion of so-called jumbo lending is on the rise. Those are loans over $417,000, which are considered less risky. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, reasonably calm, truth be told, given the Fed and that whole election thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This will come as news to partisans on both sides of this election, but there are some, albeit rare, but some points of policy agreement. One of them is the idea of getting back some of the estimated $2.5 trillion in profits that American companies have sitting overseas and which are thus out of the reach of American tax collectors. One idea being floated to encourage companies to repatriate that money is a tax holiday, the argument being that despite low tax rates, it would still bring back enough cash to fund a big infrastructure investment and with it, lots of jobs. If recent history is any guide, though, it's not going to work out that way, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
A tax holiday can be a pretty sweet deal for global American corporations. If it's anything like the 2004 measure, companies could have a window to bring profits home at a 5.25% tax rate instead of 35%. Business leaders and their political allies argued then that the tax holiday would lead to job-creating investments when that money came to America. Damaka Dharmapala, economist at University of Chicago Law School, studied what actually happened.
What we found was that the funds seemed to be used primarily for shareholder payout, that is a combination of dividends and share buybacks.
So plenty of money did come back from abroad, but companies appeared to hand most of it out to their shareholders rather than making investments that may have created new jobs. Another problem is that if corporations come to expect tax holidays from time to time, they act accordingly. Wharton School professor Anne Harrison.
Unfortunately, that does give them an incentive to wait for these kinds of tax holidays and not to bring their money back.
In that way, a tax holiday that is supposed to encourage companies to bring money back works to encourage them to hoard more overseas later. Economists of all stripes tend to be very skeptical of tax holidays, from stalwart conservatives to committed Democrats. You often hear some version of the argument made by Kim Clausing, a Reed College economics professor.
A one-time holiday is a very bad idea. I think it's only appealing to the extent that you could fold it into a broader business tax reform.
Reform means different things to different people, of course, but America's 35% tax rate is very high compared to the rest of the world. Rather than a high rate that certain corporations can game the system to get around, there's bipartisan interest in a lower rate that's applied fairly across the board. Getting there won't be easy. Ed Kleinbard saw that firsthand back when he was chief of staff of Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. He worries that another one-off tax holiday will remove pressure for companies and politicians to do the hard work of a large-scale tax overhaul.
We're guaranteeing larger problems for the future because the same screwed-up tax system in respect of international income will be in place in the future.
Politicians and business leaders complain about America's corporate tax code, and there is indeed plenty that can be fixed. But if you hear them making big claims about how a one-time tax holiday is the answer, just remember that it didn't work out the way they said it would back in 2004. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Student debt. You hear about it here and elsewhere, how much of it there is out there, often accompanied by stories of people who graduate with whopping amounts of debt, so much that it could still be dogging them by the time their own kids head to college. Those borrowers aren't the norm, but overall, there is little standing in the way of students borrowing much, much more money than they need or can pay back. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why that is.
In the back room of an office supply store in Grand Junction, Colorado, six guys who call themselves Soul Habit practice for a holiday tree lighting concert. That's 29-year-old Tim Brecken on the trombone, putting his education to work. He also wrote the music. Brecken has a BA and a master's degree in trombone performance and about $78,000 in student loans.
This month I'll make my 10th or 11th successful $0 payment, which is what I can afford.
He can pay nothing because he's in an income-based repayment plan and has never earned much above the poverty line. His music gigs don't pay much, so he also works a couple other jobs.
I don't think I really understood how much income I would probably be making and what I would be doing getting music degrees.
Like most borrowers, Brecken had to go through entrance counseling before getting that first loan check. It was online and laid out the terms of the loan, his estimated future payments, and what would happen if he defaulted.
I guess the numbers were all pretty clear on paper, but who knows what an 18-year-old really knows about that sort of thing. I just took it because it seemed like no one who had that much money would give it away without me probably being able to pay it back easily, you know?
Now, you might be wondering, why didn't someone pull that 18-year-old aside and say, are you sure you want to take on this much debt for degrees in trombone performance? I put that question to U.S. Undersecretary of Education Ted Mitchell.
The law is clear that colleges can't discourage students from getting the loans that they're entitled to.
That's right. Except in rare instances, Mitchell says colleges are not allowed to limit borrowing or discourage someone like Tim Brecken from taking on too much debt. Federal student loans are an entitlement program designed to ensure access above all. And while colleges must explain to students once at the beginning and once at graduation that they'll have to pay those loans back, they can't require any counseling in between.
Congress wants to be very careful that we're not creating impediments for students to getting the loans that they deserve, and that counseling doesn't turn into a kind of discouragement.
Those good intentions have helped land students in more than $1 trillion of debt. So the Department of Education is launching an experiment to see if more loan counseling could help students make better decisions. Yes, student loan debt is at $1.3 trillion, and the government is going to experiment with requiring more counseling.
Think of it as an annual checkup where you would meet with a financial aid officer and talk about your program of study and how much debt you have incurred so far, and really work through a number of different options.
The hope is that extra counseling could also catch more students who drop out before graduation, the most likely to default. Of course, colleges have been more than happy to take all this easy money. They can lose access to federal aid if 30% of their former students default on their debt. But that's rare, so lawmakers are looking for more ways to hold schools accountable. The experiment will also test different kinds of counseling. Many colleges rely on the federal government's online program.
Getting a loan is a big decision.
It includes a few animated videos.
And remember to accept only the loans that you need, because you'll have to repay them once you're out of school.
Then there are pages of text explaining capitalized interest and deferment versus forbearance, with a little quiz at the end of each section.
Some of the information is highly technical, and it's hard to decide what is relevant to a borrower's particular situation and what is irrelevant.
Jennifer Wang directs the Washington, D.C. office of the Institute for College Access and Success.
But I do want to kind of push back on the idea that people are borrowing because they don't really know what they're doing.
Wang says people are borrowing because tuition has gone up much faster than grants and scholarships. In Colorado, Tim Brecken says he might have benefited from more loan counseling.
I'm not 100% sure it would have made a difference. I was like probably especially idealistic and looking for a ticket out of the small town I was in at the time.
He hopes to start selling some of the jazz and classical trombone arrangements he's been writing. But he says it will probably be decades before he knows if he can earn enough from music to have made all that debt worth it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, you can't save up money while you're paying for a roof over your head on a daily basis.
The cost of living as a social exile in America. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 77 points on this Wednesday, 0.4%, 17,959, 7 straight down days for those counting. The NASDAQ off 48 points, 0.9%, 5,105. The S&P 500 off 13 points, 0.6%. 2097. With open enrollment for employer health plans underway, probably a busy month for the TriNet Group. It provides human resources support to small and medium-sized businesses. After beating third-quarter estimates, TriNet up 14% today. Barrett Business Services targets the same-sized companies, but its specialty is staffing, on-demand, short-term contract, long-term, you name it. Barrett up 0.6% today. Bond prices were down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.80%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Much as one shouldn't bet the ranch on daily fluctuations in this stock or that, so too should one not take Election Day solace from any individual poll. And Lord knows there are enough of them out there right now. Polls, that is. Because, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, as with much else in politics, they are a business opportunity.
Public polling doesn't only happen during election years, but it is when polls become most prominent in the public eye.
Yeah, I mean, election season is basically the Super Bowl of polling.
Joshua Clinton studies politics and polls at Vanderbilt University.
I mean, this is like the big event because every time you release a poll, you're almost guaranteed to get news coverage.
Vanderbilt is one of many universities that run political polls, and those schools have a big incentive to run lots of them during a campaign. They're often small universities that might not otherwise get attention, like Monmouth, Quinnipiac, Marist. Another business that jumps into election year polling? The news business.
General assessments of the race. An ABC News, Washington Post survey just out today. In fact,
campaign 2016 segment tonight, brand new Fox News poll just released 2 hours ago.
According to our new CBS News battleground tracker out today,
news organizations usually outsource the phone calls and online surveys that yield these results. David Dutwin is chief methodologist at polling company SSRS. He says the election is a chance to get some free advertising in for polling companies as well.
For sure, you know, when we're on ABC this week with George Stephanopoulos every week and he cites the SSRS poll, that's really helpful to us because, you know, we don't have a traditional advertising pipeline.
What he means is there's not really a magazine or a TV show where he could advertise and catch all the people who buy polling services. And polls aren't cheap. A national poll that has a representative sample can easily run $30,000 to $50,000. That's a lot of phone calls, like these provided by Dutwin's firm, SSRS.
Would you vote for Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine or Donald Trump and Mike Pence?
Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine.
Or do you support Donald Trump because you dislike the other candidate?
These kinds of polling calls can easily last 20 minutes, and hand-dialing those cell phone and landline numbers, hoping to catch someone willing to talk, leads to pretty high overhead. So David Dutwin says his company doesn't see a big difference in his bottom line during an election year.
I mean, there's a significant bump, don't get me wrong. But it's not like we're doing double the work that we do in an off-cycle year. And again, the margins of that kind of work are, it's competitive work. And, you know, the margins reflect that.
And it's getting even more competitive, with online polling companies like SurveyMonkey getting into the business. But Vanderbilt's Clinton says it's still worth it for these companies because there's not always an election running to spur business.
Pollsters who do very, very well can then use this as advertising to go to their clients in non-presidential years or non-election years to say, look how well we did at predicting the presidential election. You know, you can trust us when you want to do your consumer surveys.
And that kind of work keeps polling companies in business when they aren't in the headlines. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We did one too, by the way, a poll, that is. You can dig into the data, check out our Economic Anxiety Index, and take our quiz too. See where you rate Anxiety Wise at marketplace.org. You think of roadside motels, you think of an inexpensive place to stay when traveling, right? In some cities, though, they have become places people basically get stashed because they have nowhere else to go, and roadside motels become known as residential motels. Kent State sociologist Christopher Dumm spent a year staying in one that he called the Boardwalk Motel to tell the stories of the people who live there. His new book is called Exiled in America. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Do me a favor, would you, and define a term for me here, this idea of a residential motel. What is that?
This is a place, a motel that has sort of taken on a new life, so to say, that it's not catering to people traveling on highways in vehicles, and instead it's servicing people who, for any number of reasons, were homeless, disabled, suffering from mental illness, so people who really needed a place to stay, who didn't quite fit in, who are on the margins of society and are using it as a residence, as some place to live instead of some place to stay while they're going from point A to point B.
There are some pictures in this book taken by you, and please don't take offense, but they're not great. Do me a
I'm a sociologist, not a photographer.
There you go. Fair enough. Tell me what – pick a room of one of these residents, and there are dozens of them, obviously. Pick a room and describe it for me. I mean, what kinds of – how have they made it home, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. So this one couple, Dee and Toby, they were recovering heroin addicts. And they went through a tremendous amount of trouble to make their room feel homey because most of the motel rooms have numerous code violations. And so living there is very psychologically stressful. Dee specifically put some decorations around the mirror above the bathroom sink because in her mind, it made it feel like a kitchen window. And she said in her home, she always wanted a kitchen window. And it sort of brought up these ideas of home and comfort.
Yeah. You paid $205 a week for your room, which I imagine you can afford out of your academic's salary. Where do the folks who live there get their money? Do they have salaries? Do they get government stipends? How does that work?
Some of them are working minimum wage jobs. Others are receiving supplemental assistance from DSS.
It's Department of Social Services, yeah.
Right, Department of Social Services. So there's some in that case, no money is actually going through the person who's staying. It's all going from DSS to the motel's owner through a contract. But the problem is, yeah, so you think about $205 a week, that's $820 a month for a room with no kitchen, with maybe no hot water or heat. So it's not a sustainable place to live. People would always ask me, why don't they rent apartments? Well, if you're trying to save up $820 a month and you're scraping by for that, it becomes incredibly hard to leave. You can't save up money while you're paying for a roof over your head on a daily basis.
Yeah. They actually set up, these folks did, sort of an informal underground, well, I guess it was kind of formalized actually, but an underground economy.
Yeah. That was one thing that really, really impressed me and surprised me. So they're exchanging goods and services with each other. They're selling things that people need. Someone might need a microwave, and this person has $20, so they make a trade. Or this person wants cigarettes, and they'll make a trade. But they're also exchanging emotional resources as well, just the simple fact of creating friendships and social ties together, which is very important to them as well.
The epilogue here is that after you leave, the Boardwalk Motel gets shut down.
It did get shut down by the town. It was a really tragic saga, I think, of all these different social forces combining sort of this perfect storm of neglect and misunderstanding. And the sad part is that it affected real people's lives in the dead of winter.
You called it a sterilization of social space. What happened to the people?
People didn't realize that the motel was closing the day that it actually occurred. They had no idea. So people just scattered. One guy, I remember, just dealt with it by drinking a lot of beer and then just getting up and walking out into the cold.
It's a book called Exiled in America, Life on the Margins in a Residential Motel by Christopher Dumm. Christopher, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
This final note on the way out today, into which we will roll antitrust law, AT&T, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and eventually the World Series. This afternoon, the Justice Department filed suit against AT&T, which you will remember is in the process of buying Time Warner. The suit accuses AT&T's subsidiary, DirecTV, of illegally negotiating with other cable networks to block carriage of the cable TV channel showing Los Angeles Dodgers games here in Los Angeles. Not one would imagine how AT&T and Time Warner want to go into those big antitrust reviews. Also about the World Series. Sorry, I almost forgot. Go Cubs. Come on. You got it, right? Who we got to go? We're a little late. Down was the word on Wall Street today. How about that? Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.